Welcome to Salty Moms Gone Sober. Whether you are a sober, curious, salty individual, can't seem to stay on the wagon, or have some successful sober time under your belt, our podcast creates a safe and comfortable space to let it all out. We can't guarantee anything but a good time and chill vibes. With a dash of humor, genuine language of the heart, and a salty truth throat punch here and there, connect with us on this unpredictable wave of sobriety. And when we find ourselves choking on a mouthful of saltiness, let's stop waiting to exhale and just spit some truth. Without further ado, your hosts, Alyssa Gruskin and Bree Juarez.
Hey guys, Alyssa here. Welcome to another episode of Salty Moms Gone Sober.
Hey guys, Bree here. Thank you for joining us. This evening, we have another amazing guest. Alyssa, would you like to introduce him?
So we have a really awesome guest here today. His name is Tim Lodgen, and he is going to tell us a little bit about his addiction, recovery, and mental health. So Tim, why don't you go ahead and start?
Okay, well, first of all, thanks for having me, guys. I really appreciate it. And I grew up in a normal family. No drugs and alcohol in my family. My father was a police officer. My mother actually was a professional bodybuilder. Then she became a vice president of a big company. I think I've seen her drink 5 beers in her entire life. My father was an occasional drinker at holidays or family functions, but there was no alcohol in my house. There was no drugs in my house. So it wasn't around me at all. I was very athletic. I played many sports, baseball, football. I was a junior Olympic boxer, a golden glove boxer, and then I was almost a professional skateboarder in my teenage years. I actually grew up with Brandon Novak and Bucky Lasik, a guy named Matt Martin. I used to skate with Rob Dyrdek. Like, it was a very awesome time from 13 to 17 years old. I was really blessed to be around those kind of athletes. It was awesome. I didn't drink or drug. Ninth grade, we had a freshman party, and that was the first time I tried alcohol. And I got drunk, and I got so sick. And the next day, my mom picked me up from the party, and she knew I had a hangover. And her punishment was, we were having a cookout that day. She wanted me to shuck 50 ears of corn as my punishment. And she gave me 2 paper bags, one to throw up in and one to shuck the ears of corn in. And that was my punishment. And that was enough for me. I didn't touch alcohol again until my senior year of high school. At the age of 14, going into high school, I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And in the 90s, they call it bipolar disorder, manic depressive. My mother didn't believe in putting teenager on medicine at that time. So she kind of was just like, I believe she was kind of in denial and didn't want to face the fact that I had something going on. But I will tell you that having bipolar actually helped me excel in sports, because I would get in my manic modes and there was nothing that could stop me from excelling, and I wouldn't stop. I would just keep going. I'd keep training. I'd keep doing what I had to do, and I'd get on these really high highs. But when I lost, or I couldn't land a trick, I would get very, very sad and pretty much beat myself up on why I wasn't good enough to do the trick, or why I lost. Maybe I didn't train hard enough. And then I'd go into these big manic modes. So I dealt with that from 14 all the way into my senior year. But senior year, I signed up for the military. I was going into the Marine Corps. So I was like, you know what? I'm gonna have some fun my senior year and go to some parties. Started going to parties. I started drinking, started smoking pot, started doing LSD. We had PCP around. I started doing some of that, taking mushrooms. I would occasionally get a painkiller here or there, but I was open to anything. For some reason, I was never interested in doing cocaine or heroin. I just, for me, I was like, I don't want any of that, but I'll stick with all the, I guess you would say, hippie drugs, you know, the LSD and the pot and stuff like that. But I thought it was a phase. I was like, you know what? I'm going in the Marines at the end of school. I'll get this out. Let me have some fun. So I graduated high school. I went into the Marines, and all of the drugs did stop. As soon as I got into the military, that all stopped. But my alcoholism skyrocketed about 10 times. That's all we did is we trained and then we drank. And we trained and drank. And that was an everyday thing from the age of 18 all the way up to age of 20 until I got discharged from the Marines. And, you know, I get home. I'm 20 years old. And the first month home, it was kind of a relief. I was like, I'm out of the military. I can relax. I don't have to be up at a certain time. I don't have to wear a certain uniform. I don't have any rules. And the first month was really great. I'm home. I'm 20. I got to get a job. I got to get a car. I got to start taking care of myself. And my depression started to set in. In the Marines, I couldn't tell them I had bipolar or else I wouldn't have been able to join the military. So I wasn't on medicine from the age of 14 all the way up to 20. Being home, house, and I found myself one day with my stepfather's gun in my lap, and I was contemplating taking my own life. And luckily, I had a girlfriend at that time, and I called her, and I told her what was going on, and she came over, and she took the gun away, and she put it up in my stepdad's dresser, and I told my mom, hey, I'm extremely depressed. You know, something's going on. I got to see a doctor. I never told her that I pulled a gun out and put it in my lap because I knew she would have had me committed at that time. But she did get me back into seeing doctors, and they did confirm I had bipolar disorder. And so they started putting me on medicines. Well, I never indulged to them that I was still drinking every single day, and I had started smoking pot again since I was out of the military. So the medicines that they were putting me on were not working. It didn't matter what combination they put me on, what dosage they put me on, nothing ever worked. And I never told them this because I have drugs and alcohol in my system. Of course, they're not going to work, but I never told them that. So their solution was just try these, let's try this. Maybe you should go to more counseling. But I never was true to myself, and I was never true to my doctors that the actual fact was I had drugs and alcohol in my body, so those medicines were never going to work. So from the age of 20 up until, you know, from the age of 20 until, you know, March 5th of 2020, I drank every single day. It started off with beer and smoking pot, and then around the age of 32, I started doing mixed martial arts, and my body started breaking down, and I had to have 7 surgeries within a time of like 17, 18 months, and the doctors were giving me pain medicine like they were Tic Tacs. They never asked me to wean off. They would just ask me how I was doing. It was more of a pain management. They weren't trying to get me off. They weren't trying to see if I was getting better. They just wanted to manage the pain. And of course, like any good addict, I wasn't taking one every 4 hours. I was taking 2 or 3 every 4 hours, and my script would be 2 weeks into it and I'd be done the bottle. I got to the point where it started to scare me. I was like, I'm drinking every day and I'm taking all this pain medicine. This is exactly how people die. And I got genuinely scared that I was going to die one night in my sleep because of this pain medicine. And I remember thinking to myself, if I'm going to die, I'm going to do it by my own hands. I'm not going to die in my sleep. So I went into my bedroom, and I had a bottle, and I had 18 Percocets in it. And I took all 18, and I drank 12 beers. And I remember laying in bed thinking, please don't let me wake up tomorrow because I can't live like this anymore. That next day I woke up, I went into the bathroom. I had a full bottle of Percocet sitting there, and I dumped all 30 of them into the toilet. And I remember looking in the mirror and telling myself, I don't care how bad this gets. Remember this day because I never want to feel like this again. And for the next week and a half, I was extremely sick, throwing up, going to the bathroom, sweating, nausea, couldn't eat. I mean, the whole deal. And I remember looking in the mirror every day, crying and just looking like shit and saying, don't forget how you feel because you never want to do this again. That was the last time I took pain medicine, and that's been close to 7 years now, maybe even 8. I did that on my own. But I generally think it scared me so bad that I had an awakening, kind of, but it didn't stop me from drinking. You know what I mean? I was kind of like, well, I'm not taking the pain medicine anymore, so I'll be fine. I can continue to drink. And I remember getting in my truck one day, and we have a nice reservoir around here. And I went driving through the reservoir, and I'm crying. And I'm like yelling up into the sky. I'm like, why am I an addict? Why am I living like this? You know, why have I messed up jobs and my relationship with my family? And why can't I stop? And I get around to this tree where my senior year of high school, my best friend lost control of his vehicle and hit the tree and unfortunately lost his life at the age of 18. And at the tree, there's a book and you can talk to him and write a little note to him. And it's still there to this day. And I get out, and I go up to the tree. I'm like, Bill, man, I can't stop drinking. You know, I stopped the pain medicine, but I can't stop drinking. I don't know what to do. I don't know what my purpose is in life. I don't know why I'm here. Can you please, you know, send me a sign that I'm not alone? And I get back in my truck, and I go to leave the park, and I'm crying. I can't really drive, so I pull over on the side of the road, but I'm not facing where I'm supposed to be going out. I'm actually facing oncoming traffic on the opposite side of the street. And I sit there for about 10 minutes. And this car pulls up. And I'm watching the guy, and he gets out of the vehicle, and he grabs his dog, and he's about to walk over and go by the water and walk his dog. And I realized it was my best friend who passed away. It was his father, whom I hadn't seen since 1996, the day of his funeral. And I get out, and I'm like, Mr. Bill? And he's like, Timmy, what's wrong? And I fall to the curb, and I'm crying. I'm like, I'm an alcoholic. I'm an addict. I can't stop. I don't know why I'm here. And he comes over to me, and he puts his hand on my shoulder, and he says, Tim, I'm not even supposed to be here this morning. He said, I'm supposed to be in South Carolina visiting family. My wife came to me in a dream last night and told me to come here this morning and walk the dog. He said, that's the only reason I'm here. And I can't explain that moment, but my addictive personality and my mental illness tells me, well, now I'm being watched. I'm okay, and I can continue to drink because nothing is going to happen to me because I'm not alone and somebody is watching over me. So for the next 4 years, I drank the heaviest and the hardest that I've ever drank before in my life. The beer wasn't enough. I switched over to whiskey, and my alcoholic brain will tell me, don't buy a big bottle of whiskey because then I would know exactly how much I'm drinking. So I would go and buy the miniatures because I could do three or four of them and throw them away, and then I'd forget how much I was drinking and then go back and get a couple more. Well, at the end of my addiction, before I went into rehab, I was drinking 25 to 30 miniatures a day. Each one of those miniatures is 2.5 shots. So I was drinking upwards of 70 to 80 shots of Fireball whiskey every single day. And I got to a point where I got a new truck, and I drove to the liquor store to get some whiskey, and I hit something. I do not know what I hit. I still don't know what I hit. I don't know if it was a car or a sign, but I remember coming home. Told my wife, I hit something, I'm going to bed. And like true alcoholic fashion, I wake up the next morning and I was like, I'm going to go get some milk and some water. And my wife's like, how are you going to do that? And I sat in my truck in the driveway and she says, go look at your truck. So I go outside and the right front tire is hanging off, just mirror smashed in. And I'm like, what the hell happened? And she pops her head out and she's like, you don't know what you hit, do you? And I said, I don't. She says, you could have killed somebody or killed yourself. And she's like, you can't stay here. You got to go figure this out. So I leave and I call my friend. I'm like, hey, man, can I come to your house for a couple of days? You know, let things blow over. She'll forgive me and I'll be able to come back. And he says, sure. So I go to his house and his solution, well, now that I'm kicked out and I wrecked my truck, we might as well go to the bar and have a couple of drinks because now I have a reason to drink. So we go to the bar, do a couple shots, drink a couple beers. And as I'm leaving the bar the very next day, I rear-end somebody at a red light. And I get out and I look at his vehicle, and his vehicle's fine. Front of my bumper's all smashed up. And I was like, are you okay? He said, yeah. I'm like, your car's okay. You're okay. I'm out of here. So I slapped him on his back and I got in my truck and I left. I knew I was going to jail. I was drunk and it was a hit and run. So I left. I get back to my friend's house. I'm like, man, I can't stay here. I got to go be by myself. So I leave his house. I stop at the liquor store again. I get 10 more shots and I go and sit in a park and ride for 48 hours. And I turned my phone off because I didn't want to hear from anybody. I wanted to be by myself. I wanted to drink and wallow in my sorrows and pretty much have a big ass pity party about what I've done to myself. And for 48 hours, I sit there and I drink and pass out and I drink and I pass out. And Friday morning, March 5th, 2020, at 7 after 10, I turn my phone on. At 9 after 10, 2 minutes after having my phone off for 48 hours, I get a phone call. And it's my childhood friend, Brandon Novak. And he says, Lodging, what the fuck are you doing? And I said, I'm in my truck. I'm cold. I'm hungry. I'm tired. I'm drunk. And he says, good, motherfucker. That's what you need. He said, I just got off the phone with your wife and your mom. I have a plane ticket set for you to go down to West Palm Beach, Florida, the Banyan Treatment Centers, to go get help. He said, I promise you, if you get on that plane, you'll get back everything that you've lost times 10. Just get on the plane. I have one thing. Call me when you get past security because I want to make sure that you're getting on the plane and you're not going to catch a cab and get out of it. I say, okay. So I get off the phone with him. My wife calls and she's like, hey, I just talked to Brandon. Please come home. Take a shower. Pack your bags. Try to get some sleep because you got a couple hours before the plane leaves and try to eat something. So I get home and my anxiety's through the roof now because now I'm like, man, I got to go to Florida. I got to go to a treatment center. How did my life get this bad that I have to go to a rehab now to get myself back together? And I'm sitting on the edge of my bed, and my addiction grabs me by the hand and walks me into my basement and throws a rope around my neck and stands me on a bucket and tells me to stop the pain and jump off. And about 3 to 5 minutes go by, and I guess my wife finds out that I'm not in the bedroom. And she comes down the steps and sees me standing on a bucket with a rope around my neck. And she says, what are you doing? I said, I can't do this. And I was like, I just want the pain to stop. And she says, Tim, please, do you know what this will do to your children? Please get down, get on that airplane. Everything is going to be okay. So I get off and I sit on the floor for about 10 minutes crying. I go upstairs and I call Brandon. I'm like, hey, man, I got to go. I was like, if I don't go, I'm gonna die. This is going to kill me. And all he says is, I'm proud of you. I love you. Call me when you pass security. So my mom drives me to the airport. I get there, and I call him. I say, hey, man, I'm past security. I got about 30 minutes before the plane leaves. I just want to let you know I'm getting on the plane. And again, all he says is, I'm proud of you. I love you. And he hangs up. As I go to sit down in the chair waiting for them to call to board the plane, I sit down. And I get this overwhelming feeling of hope that came over my entire body. It was like a warm blanket feeling that I've never felt in my entire life. And something in my head said, everything's going to be okay. All my panic went away. All my anxiety went away. All my worry went away. It was as if something was telling me, at this time in my life, at 44 years old, after 27 years of suffering, pain, mental illness, and addiction, that I was finally going to go get the help that I needed to save my life. I got into rehab. I did 32 days down in West Palm Beach, Florida, and I went in full addict mode into recovery. I didn't miss any meetings. I went to extra meetings for military and first responders. I did all the homework. I did all the journaling. I shared my story. I changed my diet. I started working out at the rehab. They had a personal trainer coming in. If I was going to do this, I was going to do it mentally, spiritually, and physically. And I wanted to make sure that I was hitting all three of those because for me, I had to find that balance that truly helped me to recover. Not just get sober, but help me recover to and learn to be a different human being, a different husband, father, and son. And that place saved my life. It changed me forever. when I got home, I kept thinking it's 90 and 90, 90 and 90. And I ended up doing 98 meetings in 90 days. And I started to feel a little burnt out by going to a meeting every day. So I backed it down to 4 meetings a week. I joined the local YMCA. I started going to the gym and started working out. And now I find that what works for me at 15 months sobriety is I go to 2 to 3 meetings a week. I go to the gym Monday through Sunday. I go every single day. Even if I'm not lifting weights, I'll get on the treadmill. I'll do something physical that helps me. It's almost like I call it my church, because I go there and I can get all my frustrations out. And it raises my dopamine, my endorphins, and it really makes me feel good about myself. And I hit my meetings on the weekends because I feel as if I work all week. I go to the gym. I spend time with my family. And on the weekends, I can get my meetings in, because it's like Saturday ends the week for me, and I go to 2 meetings on Sunday, and that begins the next week for me. So it gets me recharged and ready for the week. So the way that I stay sober now is I truly believe in the balance of my family, my fellowship, my physical exercise that I have to do, and I've changed my diet completely. I eat a lot healthier than I ever have. I'm really conscious on the people that I speak to now. My group of friends has diminished severely, but I believe that's for a better cause, because we're all like-minded people now. I don't speak to many of my friends that I used to. They're all still doing the same thing, and that's just not healthy for me anymore. And I truly believe that day at the airport, I had a psychic change. Something happened to me that I can't explain, and it has changed my perception on everything. It has changed my perspective on everything. I used to not give a shit about myself, much less my family. And thank God I was never physically abusive, but I sure as shit was verbally. And I said the nastiest stuff to the people that I love the most. And now I'm just so truly grateful to have a second chance at life. I'm truly grateful that, you know, my kids talk to me now. You know, I used to come home and the house would scatter. Nobody would want to be around me because they didn't know what dad was walking in the door. Was I happy, silly, funny? Or was I angry, nasty, irritable, and didn't want to be bothered by anybody? Now that I come home, the kids come out of their bedrooms. The wife sits next to me. We eat dinner together. We watch movies. We laugh. We talk about our day. The gift that I was given of sobriety is nothing less or short of a miracle. I can't explain everything that's happened to me over this past 15 months. Because if you would have told me this in rehab, that my life would have changed this much in less than a year and a half, I would have told you to go piss up a tree. It's impossible. But it's not a coincidence anymore. I truly believe that I had to suffer. My story was 27 years of mental health and addiction problems. So that I now can share my story with truth and conviction and be myself to those still suffering. Yeah, it's not no bullshit. I don't read off a script. I lived it. I've learned from it. And I believe I found my purpose now is to share my story with as many people as possible who's suffering with mental illness and addiction, in hopes that they know that they're not alone. They don't suffer alone. The pain that they're going through is not just theirs alone. Other people go through this, and there's help out there. We can recover, and we can live the life that this higher power, I don't know what it is, but something is out there, and it has great things waiting for us, and I'm truly blessed to be alive. I'm healthy. When I got to rehab, my liver was 4 times what it should have been. My blood pressure was 167 over 130-something. I was on the verge of having a stroke. Everything is going back to normal. I'm in the best shape that I've ever been in, even including the Marines. It's amazing what living a life in recovery can do for somebody mentally, spiritually, and physically. And I get to be on these podcasts and share my story to people that could possibly be listening at the time in their life that they need to hear this message, because I gave up hope. I'm not going to lie. I did. I gave up hope twice, and it almost cost me my life. And what a shame that would have been for me not to experience this part of life, this journey. I was able to turn that page and start a new chapter, and it's been the best chapter of my entire life.
Well, thank you so much, Tim, for sharing that incredibly emotional story of, you know, your experience with addiction, mental health at such a young age, kind of sweeping that under the rug, you know, like a lot of us do at that age, and all of the dark places that your addiction took you, and all of the signs that you received throughout that journey, like your friend's dad, parked by the tree, and him being there, and his dream of his wife saying you need to go here when he was supposed to be out of town, like sharing those extremely intimate details of your life, you know, having a gun sitting in your lap because you wanted to end it, taking all of, you know, taking so many Percocet and drinking so much because you wanted to be in control of how you went out, and then finally leading up to, you know, experiencing true desperation, living in your car for 2 days and with your phone off, getting drunk, and then, you know, getting this option to go to rehab, and still that alcoholic brain, that untreated mental illness, puts a noose around your neck in your garage. It's like, what's worse, going to rehab or dying an alcoholic death, you know, hanging myself? What's worse? And you were so fortunate to have the people in your life that love you and believe in you to push you to the point where you did feel that blanket of hope, because you weren't going to feel it until you received that gift of desperation. And you had a lot of desperate moments, some that might be other people might only have a need one of those, or like a portion of that, and be, you know what I mean? Like, you were a dedicated fucking alcoholic, man. You know? And like so many times, you know, like even quitting pain pills, it was like, well, that's just justification for me to be able to drink more. Because yep. Now the pain pills are gone, so I can still drink just as much as I want to. And, you know, like, there's just that, all the justification that goes through our head with stuff like that. So just thank you so much for sharing such an honest experience, and just, like, what you said, you know, the true reality, the bitter, ugly language of the heart, you know, like, it was your experience. That's amazing. And I would love to hear what your life kind of looks like now, some things that you're doing, and some of the outreach that you are involved in.
Yeah, so, you know, when I was in rehab, I the first 2 weeks I didn't want to share. Like, I just felt uncomfortable. I wasn't ready. And, you know, I met a group of guys that we hung out and we kind of became friends. We really did become friends. And one guy kept hey man, you need to share. You know, you've told us your story. You need to share because the way you share your story, it's going to hit a lot of people. And I was like, nah, no, it's not. Nah, I'm just not ready to do it. You know, nobody wants to hear what I have to say. And he said, I'm telling you, man, just when you're ready, you need to share your story. So when I got home, about 4 or 5 months into my sobriety, you know, I started following sober pages on Instagram, sober pages on Facebook, and I started listening to sober podcasts, and it kind of gave me an inspiration. I was like, you know what? I think I would like to share my story. So I started reaching out to some podcasts and just told them a little back, you know, like a little biography of my story. And I didn't even have 6 months sober at the time. And I was like, I would love to come on and share because I felt as if I found my purpose. Like something happened to me in that chair in the airport. And I wanted to show people that recovery is possible. And no matter how bad it gets, no matter how hopeless you feel, we can turn our lives around. So I started messaging podcasts, and they started messaging me back. And I started becoming guest speakers on podcasts. And I think tonight is my 42nd podcast I've been on in 15 months. I open my messages now, and podcasts ask me to come on. I still message a lot of podcasts, but yesterday I opened it up, and there was 3 podcasts asking me to come on. And the messages that I receive in my inbox humble the shit out of me. I have no other way but to say it is I've got messages from around the world that I never would have been able to reach. These people never would have heard my story if I wasn't able to share my story on a podcast. So I'm coming to California in September. They asked me to come down and speak at a mental health and addiction seminar for first responders and veterans. You know, I'm dealing with suicide thoughts and mental illness. I was interviewed by two mental health magazines. I'm looking at becoming like not a life coach, but like a mental health advocate coach. And something also to do with fitness, because I really believe that changing my diet and working out has been a tremendous help for my mental health. It has really given me back my self-confidence, which I never wanted to look into the mirror. I hated the person staring back. And now I can look in the mirror and actually love the person that stares back to me. And I want to give that to people. I don't want to get paid for it. I don't want fame or fortune. I want to give them something that was given to me by my friend. You know, the fact that he reached out, the fact that he got me into a bed in a very nice place in Florida, the fact that he cared when he didn't have to. He didn't have to make that phone call. He didn't have to call me. He didn't have to set up that airplane ticket. He did that out of the kindness of his heart because he was once there himself. And isn't that what we do in recovery? We help each other. You know, one more is one less. One more person that I could help is one less person that could possibly take their own life, possibly die of addiction. And that's what I really truly want to do is I want to talk and speak to as many people as possible. I would love to become a TEDx speaker. I've been looking into that. Coaching people fitness-wise and mental health-wise. You know, I used to think that I'd have to go to school to get all that acknowledged, but I had 27 years of experience, so I don't resent that anymore. I actually look at that as, you know, that's why I had to go through that. I had to live through hell to experience this gift that I have now. And that makes me extremely grateful. I just finished a bodybuilding competition for Muscle and Fitness Magazine. at 46 years old, and I came in third place. I never would have imagined that a year and a half ago. There's no freaking way I even would imagine that. But I wanted to try it. I'm open to new things now. It's like I have a second chance in life, and I want to try things that I've never been able to do because of my addiction and my mental health. And I'm going to compete in a bodybuilding competition in November of this year. I'm just trying to completely show people that we can change our lives and we can chase our dreams, and we don't have to die from this disease of mental health and addiction. It doesn't have to be that way. We can change our stars and become the person we've always wanted to be.
Absolutely. And with the negative stigma, obviously, on mental health and addiction, not that many people are willing to go into such honest depth about their addiction and mental health disorder. And there's a reason why you did live that for so long. And there is a reason why you went to hell and back so you can spread that word to the next sick and suffering addict that thinks that nobody else is going to understand. And you are a person who wants to share that story. And it's people like you that are helping save lives every day, you know, by doing that. And just like you said, like, you're not looking for fame, you're not looking for fortune. You are trying to do what your friend did for you, because he was once in that place. And you are just doing the right thing by taking your message and letting it be your recovery and sharing it with the world. And that is a blessing and truly inspiring. It's amazing.
It's amazing to not live a life of deceit and manipulation and just a scummy person. You know what I mean? It feels right to give back. And it makes me feel like I'm worth something for the first time in my life. I've always felt worthless because of the mental health and the addiction. And it just feels right inside. It's not anything else, but it feels like the right thing to do. And I've lived my life in such a long time in such a bad place, and I have to give back. I have to do this.
Yeah. And you've found passion in life too, and you connection with your family, and you know, your passion is like the physical fitness, and that might not be everybody's outlet or passion. So anybody listening, do not think that you get a free Relate Out pass because you're not into your physical fitness, okay? We will substitute physical fitness with reading the trilogy that you've always wanted to read, or writing the book you've always wanted to write, or taking the bicycle ride across country you've always wanted to take, or going back to school, and we'll replace it with that. So no relating out here, people. It's not possible, okay?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, to each is its own. That was just what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And my daughter asked me the other day, she said, "Dad, you know, since you've been sober," I was a big artist in high school, and I painted and drew. And she's like, why don't you start drawing and painting again? And I said, you know, I didn't think about that. She goes, "Dad, you were really happy when you did that." And it's just something I lost passion for because the alcohol and the drugs and the mental illness took over, and that's what it does. It steals everything that you love away from you.
Yeah, it takes your identity. Turns you into a completely different person that you don't even know when you look in the mirror, just like you said. So, Tim, we are coming to, unfortunately, the end of our episode. It's been an absolute honor speaking with you and just listening to you. And I mean, you have so much to teach, yet you're so humble about it. And that is the recipe for hope for others out there that are suffering. And I just thank you so much for your time and for what you do.
Thank you guys for having me. I'm honored that you guys asked me to come on, because like I said, we never know who's listening to these podcasts. We never know what they're going through at the time that they click play. And we never know what we're going to say that could be that one, not even paragraph, one sentence, one word that we say that could help them and give them the hope that they need at that time to get the help that they need to save their life. You know, what you guys are doing, having a podcast to even have guests come on, is truly amazing. The work that you guys are doing is incredible. And I thank you for even having the podcast and having guests come on to share their story, because what you're doing gives us the outlet to share our story. And I applaud both of you. It's amazing.
Thank you.
Thank you. What an incredible, inspirational, powerful story. I'm like, for once, speechless, and I'm not speechless very often. You know, just so grateful you could be on the show and share your story. And I know it's going to help so many people. And, you know, just grateful that you're here to share and to be there for people and give back to the community. So we're really grateful you were able to come on today.
Thank you so much to all our listeners. If you liked what you heard, tune in next Sunday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time for another episode of Salty Moms Gone Sober. Be there or be square. And in the meantime, stay salty.